Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up over the next half hour, made famous by the novel The Da Vinci Code, this Scottish chapel has for centuries been surrounded by mystery and perhaps murder. The answer to the whodunit could lie forgotten in the Vatican's secret archives. And these outer space beauties provide scientists with incredible insight into the makings of the universe. We go to the Vatican Observatory to see one of the world's largest collections of meteorites, and it belongs to the Holy See. Astrological symbols, little green men, American corn, roses, and stars. Not the usual decoration you'd expect in a Christian church. But something in this mysterious ancient chapel led Templar knights and simply the curious to seek in its nooks and crannies the legendary Holy Grail. A murder is rumored to have taken place within its walls, and the killer's name could well be buried under piles of old documents in the Vatican's own secret archives. The wildly ornate 15th century Roslin Chapel, just outside of Edinburgh, Scotland, has for centuries generated animated speculation over the meaning of its unusual stone carvings and architectural plan. But it shot to worldwide fame after the success of Dan Brown's fiction novel, The Da Vinci Code. It was here in Roslin, today an Episcopal church, that the heroes of Dan Brown's fictional story found the clues that led them to solve a centuries-old tale of mystery. Among the whodunits researchers have tried to solve over the centuries, could Roslin have been a pagan temple disguised as a Christian church? And did Freemasons have a hand in designing the church? Well, Scottish historian Michael Turnbull unveils some of the mysteries and debunks the myths associated with the church in his book, Roslin Chapel Revealed, released by Sutton Publishing. He took me on a virtual tour of this special, formerly Catholic, church.
The thing that really makes it special is its size. It's been described as a pocket cathedral. It's based on Glasgow Cathedral, which was built some 200 years before, but everything is in miniature. And it's the fact that so much intricate and absolutely exuberant carving has been packed and crammed into this small chapel, which is, by the way, unfinished. They've only actually completed the choir, with a Victorian baptistry added on later. It's that really, the size, the scale of everything that makes it unique. And, of course, its geographical position. It's in the middle of an absolutely a sort of time warp, a time capsule of landscape with the river just below it and the castle. And it's a really magical place.
So let's take a look quickly at the history of the chapel. Who first founded it?
It was Sir William Sinclair who built the Collegiate Church, began building it in the 1440s. And evidently a collegiate church is a sort of cost-effective way of getting some of the benefits of a large working monastery, because there only would have been about five priests and two singing boys in the chapel, and they would have spent most of their time, it has to be pointed out, praying the divine office. Rather than saying Mass, they would have said a Mass daily, perhaps two or three on certain occasions in the year, but they spent most of their time singing and praying the divine office right through the night and during the day.
Well, in his book, Dan Brown linked the Sinclair or the St. Clair family to Mary Magdalene. Is there any truth in that, or is that just a myth?
There's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that there was any physical liaison between Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene, apart from friendship and humanity.
Well, some researchers now have put forward the theory that the chapel wasn't really Christian at all, that symbols that contained there prove that the St. Clairs who built it were not Templars, as some have
been calling them, but actually members of a pre-Christian pantheistic sect called, correct me if I'm wrong, the Ebionites, who denied Christ's divinity. They point to astrological symbols, so-called green men figures with leaves growing out of them as symbols of nature and sun worship. Apparently also Jewish, Hindu, and Islamic elements have also been found in the chapel too. I would think that such symbols are quite uncommon in Christian churches. This church really is different at a symbolic level, isn't it?
Yes, well, the Christian story really begins with three wise men, three astrologers from Persia, who followed a star. So there is some astrology, if you like, in the Christian story. Jesus was a carpenter. He worked with wood, so you might say he was a green man also. But there is absolutely no connection between the Ebionites and the chapel, because you have to understand the environment in which the chapel was created. The King of Scotland ruled with an iron fist, and anybody who stepped out of line would have been instantly executed. And I can give you an example of this when the Earl of Roslin challenged rather foolishly King Robert the Bruce while he was riding on the nearby hills, in the Pentland Hills. He challenged him that his two dogs could kill a white deer before the king's. So the king said, fine, if your dogs kill it first, I will give you lots of land and titles, and if mine kill it first, then you are dead. I will chop your head off. Fortunately, the Earl of Roslin's dogs got there first, and he went on from success to success. And the king, of course, was subject to the Pope. So we're talking about a closed society where the king knew everything that was going on, and that was one of the reasons for hunting, because he could get close to his men and discuss what was happening and get all the gossip. If anybody stepped out of line or was doing anything that the king didn't approve of, then he would be imprisoned or possibly executed.
What about the stories that link the chapel with the quest for the Holy Grail, the goblet or the cup that Jesus drank from at the very Last Supper? Is there any chance that the chapel holds that secret?
Not as far as we know. It's been x-rayed a number of times. People have tried to attack the chapel with a JCB digger. There have been attempts possibly to damage the chapel in different ways to try and discover what's in the vaults. And when some drilling was done a number of years ago, they drilled into the underground sort of compartments underneath the chapel, the vaults. But every time the drill went through, the sand poured in afterwards. So the chapel is actually built on compacted sand, and it does have compartments underneath where the Roslin family would have been buried. And it probably marks also the underground crypt, which features in the Da Vinci Code film, is possibly the remains of a first castle. They've searched it from every angle possible and using every technology imaginable, and so far there is nothing there. And if the Holy Grail was there, so what? You know, what would that prove? How would that change things? Assuming that the Holy Grail existed.
What about people who've researched the chapel or legends that say that the Freemasons were involved with the building of it or the Knights Templar?
Well, the Grand Lodge of Scotland in Edinburgh has written at least one book attacking the idea that there is any association whatsoever between modern Freemasonry and Roslin Chapel. What there is, of course, a connection between stonemasonry. Now, the stonemasons are totally different from the Freemasons. The Freemasons came into being after the Scottish Reformation. The stonemasons were stonemasons as you find today, people who work stone. What did happen was that in the 1860s, the Earl of Roslin, who was the Grand Master Mason of Scotland, entertained the Masons a number of times in the chapel and around the chapel, but he also inserted Masonic emblems when the carvings came to be replaced, when carvings had been damaged by erosion or whatever and were taken out. The design of the new carvings had to be submitted to the Earl, and it's my belief that when David Bryce, the architect, submitted the designs and the Earl approved them, the designs were quasi-Masonic. They were kind of tweaked to correspond to the Earl's Masonic beliefs. And so, yes, there is a Masonic connection with Rosalind Chapel, but it began in the 1860s. The point about the Templars is that a Templar swore a number of vows of chastity, poverty, and obedience to his order. Now, none of the barons, the Sinclairs, or the Rosalinds, were unmarried, as far as I know. They were married. They were also not poor. They were rich. And they did not follow any religious order. So what they were, in fact, was crusaders and not Templars. There were some Templars in Scotland, only about five at any one time. They were of a relatively lowly rank. And they were tried at Holyrood in 1309, in December, at Holyrood Abbey. And numerous witnesses, including a member of the Rosalind family, the Sinclair family, were there. And all they could find against the Templars was that they were secretive and they were rather tight with money. There was no devil worship or anything like that.
Apparently there's also a red pentagon or a star-shaped window over a large rose window from the 1800s. And it reportedly shines a bright red light just 2 days a year, which happened to be the very first day of spring and the first day of winter. That's also quite an interesting symbol. And also one of the latest claims is that there's a musical score which has been discovered hidden in some of the stonework and actually now put to music. Are there other mysteries yet to be revealed?
Well, there is the American corn, which I've had two university botanists look at. They've written research papers, and they definitively state that there is no recognizable botanical shape in any of the carvings, the decorations of the chapel. They're just generalized forms which were used all over Europe. If we take the light box, for example, to Hill and Adamson, the celebrated photographers, paper negatives, which are in Glasgow University Library archives, show that the tracery, the stone tracery of the great east window, 1840s, was totally different to what it is today. Again, the tracery was taken out, the medieval tracery was taken out in the 1860s, replaced with Victorian tracery when the stained glass was inserted. And it's then that the triangle of red light, of red glass, was put in. So, yes, there is a triangle of red glass on the top of the rose window, but it shines not only twice a year, but quite often, as one of the priests in charge has told me. But it's a Victorian addition. Yeah, I have to say that as far as the Da Vinci Code, the book, Dan Brown's book, was concerned, I found it a gripping read. I read it in one session, more or less. The film I looked at, but I have to say that there is no Star of David on the floor or carved into the floor of the chapel, and there's certainly no subterranean modern office under the crypt. And there's another item that people have written about, which is the what they call the matrix or matrix drawings in the lower chapel, the crypt. These are scribings. They've been scored into the stone. What they in fact are is the masons trying to work out the angle of the different curves for the arches, etc., and the pinnacles. And some people have taken these to be something to do with extraterrestrial or some mythical expression. They're quite simply working drawings, and you can find them in some of the books that have survived in continental libraries, exactly the same thing. They're just architects' drawings, nothing to do with mother goddesses or spaceships or anything.
Was this chapel at any time specifically a Catholic chapel? Now, of course, it's an Episcopal chapel.
It was built as a Catholic chapel under the Pope and the King of Scotland, and would have been consecrated by the Archbishop or the Bishop, and you can see the consecration crosses on the chapel. It was a Catholic chapel, and the family of the Rosalind, the Sinclairs, were Catholics until 1560, when the Scottish Reformation took place. And repeatedly, the Sinclairs were ordered to break down the altars, and repeatedly they resisted. The various altar plates and vestments were destroyed. But eventually, the Sinclairs were forced to give in, and they did break down the stone altars to some extent. And then follows a period of sort of silence, really, until the 1860s, when it was reconsecrated a Scottish Episcopal church, and it has remained that to this day. But interestingly enough, one of the priests in charge, the Reverend Roland Walls, became a Catholic priest, and he has set up an experimental ecumenical community along with an existing retired Scottish Episcopal priest in charge of Roslyn Chapel, not about half a mile away from the chapel, and they live there under an orders, the rules of an order, observing poverty and chastity and obedience.
So you say it's an ecumenical community. They're trying to bring Catholics and Episcopalians, Anglicans together?
Yes, they're living the pain of separation.
As the healing of those old wounds of separation between the Roman and Protestant churches remains just out of reach, the solution to another ancient conundrum may be closer to hand, a possible murder in Roslyn Chapel.
At the end of the book, I challenge my readers to uncover one last mystery, one mystery that we know about at present. In 1486, Archbishop Sheaves of St. Andrews was in Rome, and among some of the business that he was conducting, he was granting a petition to cleanse Roslyn Chapel because an act of sacrilege had taken place in it, possibly a murder. So the mystery that I would like somebody to solve is what exactly was the nature of the sacrilege that was committed in around about 1480 in Roslyn Chapel. The answer is in the secret Vatican archives, probably in the registration of bulls, because the original petitions, I think, have been lost. So part of the answer lies in the secret Roman archives.
Historian Michael Turnbull is author of Roslyn Chapel Revealed, released by Sutton Publishing. You might be forgiven if you walk right past the glass case they're displayed in at the Vatican's observatory in the hills outside Rome. That's what I did on a recent visit to the stargazing facility at the Pope's summer residence in Castel Gandolfo. I was there to find out more about the Vatican Observatory's summer program for young astronomers, but I took an unexpected detour. At first glance, they look like some of the volcanic stones you can pick up just down the hill along the beach of Lake Albano, formed in the crater of an extinct volcano. But as I walked by the display case, Jesuit father and astronomer Guy Consolomagno grabbed me by the arm and pointed enthusiastically to the series of gray, brown, red, yellow, and black stones contained inside. "Just look at these babies," was written all over his face as he eagerly told me I was looking at one of the largest collections of meteorites in the world, and he's in charge of it. The Vatican Observatory collection contains more than 1,000 pieces from nearly 500 different meteorite falls. Father Consolomagno gave me a fast-track history, explaining a large part of the collection came to the Vatican in a series of donations from Adrien Charles, the Marquis de Moroy.
He was a French gentleman scientist of the 19th century. He got these meteorites the old-fashioned way. He bought them. He bought them from dealers who were in the 19th century going around to any region where there was a lot of farmland, so the farmers would be out plowing the fields, and no mountains nearby. So whenever they encountered a rock that wasn't there before, odds were pretty good it was a meteorite.
Look at that one. My goodness, it has yellow.
It's a marvelous thing. They're called palisites. It's a mixture of metal, iron and nickel, that has been melted and then crystallized. And mixed in with it are these beautiful big crystals of olivine. Peridot, people know that as the jewel. And the fascinating thing, of course, is not only it's so beautiful because the olivines are translucent, you can see the light through them, but also just the fact that you have these two different kinds of crystals, both molten, both crystallized, and yet they did not separate, even though the metal is much denser than the rock, tells you that this crystallizing occurred someplace where there was very little gravity. It probably was in the center of a small body that was eventually completely shattered, broken apart.
This other one over here looks really unusual. What is this one? It's Mundrabila.
Mundrabila, and we have some of the very large and odd iron meteorites. What's mixed in with that is mostly sulfide materials. That's probably not all that different from what the center of the Earth would look like. We believe that the core of the Earth is made out of iron and sulfur together. And you can see in some of these meteorites, even Sacramento Mountains up there, you see the crystals of iron and nickel, but then there's this large round blob of sulfide mixed in with it. It's simply because we have these pieces of a planet that's been broken apart, a very small planet, that we can extrapolate to what our planet must be like in the interior. You know, we haven't broken apart our planet, at least not yet, so this is the best way.
But have you come across substances which were completely unknown to scientists?
Not completely unknown. What we have instead are minerals that are exceedingly rare on the surface of the Earth, but fairly common in meteorites, or combinations. I mean, we have plenty of iron on the surface of the Earth, but it's all oxidized. In meteorites, it's all metallic, and it's rich in nickel, which is what you don't normally see. Let me give you a piece of this fellow here, one of the larger samples, because this comes from Arizona, and it was found in the desert outside of Meteor Crater.
That's heavy.
Is a lump of iron, part of the 500,000 tons of iron that hit the desert of Arizona some 50,000 years ago and made Meteor Crater. Now, most of it exploded and vaporized, and it's not there anymore. It's just the little shards on the outside that flew. So you don't find this in the center of the crater. You find this in the desert outside the crater.
Wow, that's a pretty big piece. That must be almost 12 inches.
It is. It's about 12 pounds, and it's, you know, maybe a foot by a quarter, 4 to 5 inches across. It's irregular because, of course, as it exploded, it also was flying through the air, the pieces afterwards, and bits would be melted away. So you get this sort of scalloped surface to it.
So don't tell me that it was part of the meteorite that fell down here and made this enormous hole. How big is that?
That crater is about, in kilometers, I'll translate to... It's about the size. It's not quite as big as Albano Lake. And I know the difference because in Lake Albano, we can have airplanes come in and scoop water out. But there was a fellow who tried to fly into the center of that crater and he couldn't get out because it's just too small. It's a couple of miles across. But you can go there, you know, as a tourist and stand across and see to the other side.
See that hole there?
This is about all that's left of 500,000 tons, 50,000 years ago, and probably 50 meters across.
You know, everybody always wonders what happens if another meteorite hits the Earth like that.
Well, meteorites hit the Earth at the rate of about 12,000 every year.
Goodness.
Because we can tell just from seeing how bright we get bright meteors, and even a few even brighter ones you can extrapolate from there. Also, spy satellites that were originally looking for nuclear tests instead discovered a lot of rocks hitting the top of our atmosphere. Now, the 12,000 that hit, of course, most of them hit the oceans. Most of them hit uninhabited areas. We're lucky if we can get 5 or 10 meteorites, new meteorites, every year. So the odds of getting hit are pretty slim. And yet, every year or so, somebody's house or somebody's car will get hit by a meteorite. Over here, you can see a picture.
But they're usually much smaller than,
well,
than what hit.
Usually. What usually happens, of course, the iron ones stay together as large rocks, so the big craters are formed by the iron ones. A stony meteorite, when it hits, will break into smaller bits so that they can actually survive and hit the surface of the Earth. You can see pictures we have over here of a car in Peekskill, New York, that was hit by a meteorite in 1992. And you can see it made a big hole in the car, but it didn't destroy the car. You wouldn't want to drive it, I don't think. But, you know, and you wouldn't want to be right underneath it when it hit. But the odds of actually getting hit by a meteorite are pretty slim. I tell people if you're really worried about being killed by a meteorite, there are two things that can extend your life. Number one, don't smoke. And number two, wear your seatbelt. Because those things are so much more important than worrying about a meteorite.
Although we have heard about a meteorite, which is expected to come close to the Earth, about 30 years?
There are a number of asteroids that we're beginning to discover that come close to the Earth, big enough that we can see them with telescopes, and far enough away that if we can calculate they're going to hit, we might have time to do something about it. It would take 50 or 100 years to really alter a path enough. But if we had a 50 or 100 year time scan, it would be worth doing. The other interesting thing we get out of meteorites, most of these come from the asteroid belt, the area beyond Mars, between Mars and Jupiter. But some meteorites come from planets. We can tell because their chemistry is completely different. Even though we see them fall from the sky, their chemistry is not 4.5 billion years old, but much younger. They'll be oxidized, and some of them even have gas trapped in them that tell us the planet they come from. And over here we have some examples. These two meteorites come from the moon. And we know they come from the moon because their chemistry is identical to this piece of rock, which is one that one of the astronauts brought back from the moon. Since we've been to the moon, we know what the moon's made out of. We've been there. These, we're pretty confident, come from planet Mars.
Which ones?
The ones in the middle here. Chassigny, Nacla, Sailungamir 005.
How do you know they come from Mars?
Their chemistry tells us they're very young, which means they come from a planet bigger than the moon because the rocks are younger than the moon. Their chemistry tells us they come from a planet with an atmosphere, and in some samples they've actually had the atmosphere trapped inside, and the atmosphere exactly matches the atmosphere of Mars.
But why would a planet be spewing off some of these pieces of rocks or what turn into meteorites?
Well, you know, it's fascinating. The theorists proved that it couldn't happen because Mars was too big. It would be impossible to get pieces off. And then we got these rocks, and they just have to come from Mars. So the theorists go back, and there's a wonderful principle of science that says if it did happen, it can happen. So once they knew it could happen, they went and altered their theories a little bit. It's still very controversial. There are two big ideas. One would they be that a big meteorite, that like the one that made the meteor crater in Arizona, may have hit Mars, and the shock of that bouncing off of the core mantle boundary or the mantle crust boundary on Mars would give enough energy to fling a rock off. Maybe, maybe not. The other idea is we know that buried underneath the surface of Mars, you can't see it on the surface, but underneath, are large deposits of water ice. If a rock like what made Meteor Crater hit Mars and vaporized that water, turned it into steam, it's conceivable that that explosion of steam could give some rocks enough energy to fling them off of Mars and into space. Maybe. Both of these are still controversial. But however it happened, we know it did happen. And that right there is a big advance.
Jesuit Father Guy Consolomagno is curator of the Vatican Observatory's meteorite collection, just a small part of the observatory's activities and centuries-long papal interest in the scientific study of the universe. Well, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure. If you'd like to hear this and other programs on our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Again, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.